Hello everyone, my name is Elijah David, minister of the 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation right now at the 12th Hour in Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is July 14, 2016, or it is the 11th day of Ab 2020. We will start our first service today with a song that I've written entitled, Draw Me Now, Holy Spirit. The two Babylons. We're on page 46, the top of the page. We're going to continue our series. We're going to do a little review from our last study. It says, the hidden one, Apis, being only another name for Saturn, for the cow of Athor, A-T-H-O-R, however, is a female divinity. I had to put the verb in there. They said the female divinity. But if she's a female divinity, then she is the female divinity. Corresponding to Apis is well known as a spotted cow. And it is singular that the Druids of Britain also worship a spotted cow. Rare though it be, however, to find an instance of the deified calf or young bull represented with the spots. There is evidence still in the existence that even it was sometimes so represented. For the accompanying figure 20 represents that divinity as copied by the Colonel Hamilton Smith from the original collection made by the artist of the French Institute of Cairo. When we find that Osiris, the grand god of the Egypt, under the different forms, was thus arrayed in a leopard skin, or spotted dress, and that the leopard skin dress was so indispensable a part of the sacred robes of the high priest, we may be sure that there was a deep meaning in such a costume. And what could that meaning be? But just to identify Osiris with the Babylonian god, who was celebrated as the leopard tamer, and who was worshipped even as he was as nigh as the child in his mother's arms. Thus much for Egypt, coming into Greece. Not only do we find evidence there to the same effect, but increase of that evidence for the god worshipped as a child in the arms of the great mother in Greece under the name of Dionysus, or Abacus, or Isichus, I-A-C-C-H-U-S, Icus, is by ancient inquirers expressly identified with the Egyptian Osiris. This is the case with Herodotus, who had prosecuted his inquiries in Egypt itself. Whoever speaks of the Osiris as Bacchus to the same purpose is a testimony of Diodorus Siculus. Orpheus, says he, introduced from Egypt the greatest part of the mystical ceremonies, the orgies that celebrate the wonders of Ceres, and the whole fable of the shades below. For the rites of Osiris and Bacchus are the same. Those of Isis and Ceres exactly resemble each other except in name. Now, as if to identify Bacchus with Nimrod, the leopard tamer, leopards are employed to draw his car. He himself was represented as clothed with a leopard skin. The priests were attired in the same manner, or when a leopard skin was dispensed, with the spotted skin of a fawn, was used as a priestly robe in its stead. This very custom of wearing the spotted fawn skin seems to have been imported into Greece originally from Assyria, for a spotted fawn was a sacred emblem, as we learn from the Nineveh scriptures, or sculptures, I mean. S-C-U-L-P-T-U-R-E-S, the sculptures. For there we find a divinity bearing a spotted fawn or a spotted fallow deer in his arm as a symbol of some mysterious import. The origin of the importance attached to the spotted fawn and his skin had evidently come thus. When Nimrod, as the leopard tamer, began to be clothed in the leopard skin as the trophy of his skill, his spotted dress and appearance must have impressed the imaginations of those who saw him, and he came to be called not only the subduer of the spotted one, for such is the precise meaning of Nimri, the name of the leopard, but to be called the spotted one himself, we have distinct evidence of this effect borne by Damascus, who tells us that the Egyptians, Damascus, I guess, and tells us that the Babylonians call the only son of the great goddess mother, Momus, or Malmus. Now, Momath or Malmath in Chaldee, like Nimri, signified the spotted one. Thus then it became easy to represent Nimrod by the symbol of the spotted fawn, and especially in the Grecian, wherever a pronunciation akin to that of the Greeks prevailed. For the name of Nimrod, as known unto the Greeks, was Nibrod, the name of the fawn as the spotted one. In Greece was Nibros, and thus nothing could be more natural than that Nibros the spotted fawn should become a synonym for Nibrod himself. When therefore the Bacchus of Greece was symbolized by the Nibros, or spotted fawn, as we shall find, he was symbolized, what could be the design but just covertly to identify him with the Nimrod. We have evidence that this god, whose emblem was the Nibros, was known as having the very lineage of Nimrod. From Anacreon, we find that a title of Bacchus was Ahitophilus, the son of Ahitophilus, that who was Ethiops, as the Ethiopians were Cushites, so Ethiops was Cush. Cush, says Eusebius, was he from whom came the Ethiopian. For the testimony of the Josephus is unto the same effect. As the father of the Ethiopians, Cush was Ethiops by way of the eminence. Therefore, Ephanias, referring to the extraction of Nimrod, thus speaks: Nimrod, the son of Cush and Ethiop. Now, as Bacchus was the son of Ethiops or Cush, so to the eye he was represented in that character. As Nin, the son, he was portrayed as a youth or child, and that youth or child was generally depicted with a cup in his hand. That cup to the multitude exhibited him as the god of the drunken revelry. And of such revelry in his orgies, no doubt there was abundance. But yet, after all, the cup was mainly a hieroglyphic, and that of the name of the god. Well, the name of a cup in the sacred language was Cush, and thus the cup in the hand of the youthful Bacchus, the son of Ahitophilus, shows that he was the young Cush, or the son of Cush, and the accompanying woodcut. The cup in the right hand of Bacchus is held up in so significant a way as naturally suggests that it must be a symbol. And as to the branch in the other hand, we have expressed testimony that it is a symbol. But it is worthy of the notice that the branch has no leaves to determine what precise kind of branch it is. It must therefore be a generic emblem for a branch or a symbol of a branch in general, and consequently it needs the cup as its complement. to determine specifically what sort of a branch it is. For the two symbols must be read together. And read thus, they are just equivalent to the branch of Cush, the scion or son of Cush. There is another hieroglyphic connected with Bacchus that goes not a little to confirm this, that is the ivy branch. No emblem was more distinctive of the worship of Bacchus than this. Wherever the rites of Bacchus were performed, wherever his orgies were celebrated, the ivy branch was sure to appear. Ivy, in some form or other, was essential to these celebrations. The votaries carried it in their hands, bound it around their heads, or had the ivy leaf even indelibly stamped upon their person. What could be the use, what could be the meaning of this? A few words will suffice to show it. In the first place, then, we have evidence that Kairos, or Kissos, K-I-S-S-O-S, the Greek name for ivy, was one of the names of Bacchus. And further, that though the name of Cush, in its proper form, was known to the priest in the mysteries, yet that the established way in which the name of his descendants, the Cushites, was ordinarily pronounced in Greece was not after the Oriental fashion, but as Kissaioi, or Kissaioi, that's Kissaioi. I don't know what they mean by pronouncing it twice here. This Strabo, speaking of the inhabitants of Susa, S-U-S-A, who were the people of the Cush system, C-H-U-S-I-S-T-A-N, or the ancient land of Cush, says the Susians are called Kissaioi. K-I-S-S-I-O-I. That is beyond all question, Cushites. Now if a Kissaioi, yes, K-I-S, Kissaioi, be Cushites, then Kissaioi is Cush. Then further, the branch of ivy that occupied so conspicuous a place in all the Bacchanalian celebrations was an express symbol of Bacchus himself, for Hesychius assures us that Bacchus, as represented by his priest, was known in the mysteries as the branch. From this, then, it appears how Kissos, the Greek name of ivy, became the name of the Bacchus, as the son of Cush, and as identified with him, he was sometimes called by his father's name, Kissos, K-I-S-S-O-S. His actual relation however, and his father, was specifically brought out by the ivy branch. For the branch of Kissos, which to the profane vulgar was only the branch of ivy, was to the initiated the branch of Cush. Now this god, who was recognized as the scion of Cush, was worshipped under a name which, while appropriate unto him in his vulgar character, as the god of the vintage, did also describe him as the great fortifier. That name was Bassarus, B-A-S-S-A-R-E-U-S, which in its twofold meaning signified at once. For the houser of the grapes are the vintage gatherer and the encompasser with a wall, in this latter sense identifying the Grecian god with the Egyptian Osiris, the strong chief of the buildings, and with the Assyrian Belus, who encompassed Babylon with a wall. Thus from Assyria, Egypt, and Greece, we have accumulated an overwhelming evidence, all conspiring to demonstrate that the child worshipped in the arms of the goddess mother in all these countries, in the very character of Ninus or Nin, the son was Nimrod, the son of Cush. A feature here or an incident that may have been borrowed from some succeeding hero. But it seems impossible to doubt that of that child Nimrod was a prototype, the grand original. The amazing extent of the worship of this man indicates something very extraordinary in his character, and there is ample reason to believe that in his own day he was an object of the high popularity, though by sitting up as King, Nimrod invaded the patriarchal system and abridged the liberties of mankind. Yet he was held by many to have conferred benefits upon them that amply indemnified them for the loss of their liberties and covered him with glory and renown. By the time that he appeared, the wild beasts of the forest, multiplying more rapidly than the human race, must have committed great depredations on the scattered and straggling populations of the earth, and must have inspired great terror into the minds of men. For the danger arising unto the lives of men from such a source as this, when population is scanty, is implied in the reason given by Yahweh himself for not driving out the doomed Canaanites before Israel at once, though the measure of their iniquity was full. Exodus 23:29-30. I will not drive them out from before thee in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field multiply against thee. By little and little I will drive them out from before thee until thou be increased. Okay, for the exploits of Nimrod, therefore, in hunting down the wild beasts of the field and ridding the world of monsters, must have gained for him the character of a preeminent benefactor of his race. By this means, not less than by the bands he trained, was his power acquired when he first began to be mighty upon the earth, and in the same way, no doubt, was that power consolidated. Then over and above, as the first great city builder after the flood, by gathering men together in masses and surrounding them with walls, he did still more to enable them to pass their days in security, free from the alarms under which they had been exposed in their scattered life, when no one could tell but that at any moment he might be called to engage in a deadly conflict with the prowling wild beast in the defense of his own life and of those who were dear unto him. Within the battlements of a fortified city, no such danger from the savage animals was to be dreaded. And for the security afforded in this way, men no doubt looked upon themselves as greatly indebted unto Nimrod. No wonder, therefore, that the name of the mighty hunter, who was at the same time the prototype of the god of the fortification, should have become a name of renown. Had Nimrod gained renown only thus, it had been well. But not content with delivering men from the fear of the wild beast, he set to work also to emancipate them from that fear of the Yahweh, which is the beginning of wisdom and in which alone true happiness can be found. For this very thing he seems to have gained as one of the titles by which men delighted to honor him, the title of the Emancipator or Deliverer. The reader may remember a name that has already come under his notice. That name is the name of Pharaonis. The era of Pharaonis is exactly the era of Nimrod. He lived about the time when men had used one speech, when the confusion of the tongue began and when mankind was scattered abroad. He is said to have been the first that gathered mankind into the communities, the first of mortals that reigned, and the first that offered idolatrous sacrifices. This character can agree with none but that of Nimrod. Now the name given unto him in connection with his gathering men together and offering idolatrous sacrifice is very significant. Pharaonis, Pharaonus, Pharaonis, is in one of its meanings, and that one of the most natural signifies the apostate. That name had very likely been given him by the uninfected portion of the sons of Noah. But that name had also another meaning, that is, to set free. And therefore his own adherents adopted it and glorified the great apostate from the primeval faith. Though he was the first that abridged the liberties of mankind as the grand emancipator, and hence, in one form or other, this title was handed down to his deified successor as a title of honor. All tradition from the earliest times bears testimony to the apostasy of Nimrod and to his success in leading men away from the patriarchal faith and delivering their minds from that awe of Yahweh and fear of the judgments of heaven that must have rested on them while yet the memory of the flood was recent. And according to all the principles of the depraved human nature, this too, no doubt, was one grand element in his fame. For men will readily rally around anyone who can give the least appearance of the plausibility to any doctrine which will teach that they can be assured of the happiness in heaven at last. Though their hearts and natures are unchanged, and though they live without Elohim in the world, how great was the boon conferred by Nimrod on the human race. In the estimation of the unrighteous man, by emancipating them from the impressions of the true religion and putting the authority of heaven to a distance from them, we find most vividly described in the Polynesian tradition that carries its own evidence with it. John Williams, the well-known missionary, tells us that according to one of the ancient traditions of the islanders of the South Seas, to heaven, where it is so close to the earth that men could not walk, but were compelled to crawl under them. Thus was found a very serious evil. But at length an individual conceived the sublime idea of elevating the heavens to a more convenient height. For this purpose, he put forth his utmost energy and by the first effort raised them to the top of a tender plant called a teve, T-E-V-E, about 4 feet high. There he deposited them until he was refreshed, when by a second effort he lifted them to the height of a tree called Carrica, which is as large as a sycamore. By the third attempt, he carried them to the summits of the mountains, and after a long interval of repose, and by a most prodigious effort, he elevated them to their present situation. For this, as a mighty benefactor of the mankind, this individual was deified. And up to the moment that Christianity was embraced, the deluded inhabitants worshipped him as the elevator of the heavens. Now, what could more graphically describe the position of mankind soon after the flood and the proceedings of the Nimrod or Pharaonus, the emancipator, than this Polynesian fable? While the awful catastrophe by which Elohim had showed his avenging justice on the sinners of the old world was yet fresh in the minds of men, and so long as Noah and the upright among his descendants sought with all earnestness to impress upon all under their control the lesson which that solemn event was so well fitted to teach. However, that is, Yahweh must have seemed very near to the earth to maintain the union between heaven and earth, and to keep it as close as possible must have been the grand aim of all who loved Elohim and the best interests of the human race. But this implied the restraining and discountenancing of all vice and all those pleasures of sin. After which the natural mind, unrenewed and unsanctified, continually pants. This must have been secretly felt by every unholy mind as a state of insufferable bondage. For the carnal mind is enmity against Yahweh. It is not subject to his law, neither indeed is able to be so. It says unto the Almighty, "Depart from us, for we desire not the knowledge of thy ways." So long as the influence of the great father of the new world was in the ascendance, while his maxims were regarded and a holy atmosphere surrounded the world, no wonder that those who were alienated from the Yahweh and righteousness felt heaven and its influence and authority to be intolerably near, and that in such circumstances they could not walk, but only crawl, that is, that they had no freedom to walk as the sight of their own eyes and the imaginations of their own hearts. From this bondage Nimrod emancipated them. By the apostasy he introduced, by the free life he developed among those who rallied around him, and by separating them from the holy influence that had previously less or more controlled them, he helped them to put Yahweh and the strict spirituality of his law at a distance. And thus he became the elevator of the heavens, making men feel and act as if heaven were afar off from earth, and as if either the Elohim of heaven could not see through the dark cloud, or did not regard with displeasure the breakers of his law. And all such would feel that they could breathe freely, and that now they could walk at liberty. For this, such men could not but regard Nimrod as a high benefactor. Now, who could have imagined that a tradition from Tahiti would have illuminated the story of Atlas. But yet, when Atlas, bearing the heavens on his shoulders, is brought into juxtaposition with the deified hero of the South Seas, who blessed the world by heaving up the superincumbent heavens that pressed so heavily upon it, who does not see that the one story bears a relation unto the other? Thus then, it appears that Atlas, with the heavens resting on his broad shoulders, refer to no mere distinction in the astronomical knowledge, however great, as some have supposed, but to a quite different thing, even to that great apostasy in which the giants rebelled against heaven, and in which the apostate Nimrod, the mighty one, as the acknowledged ringleader, occupied a preeminent place. According to the system which Nimrod was the grand instrument in introducing men, were led to believe that a real spiritual change of the heart was unnecessary, and that so far as change was needful, it could be regenerated by mere external means. Looking at the subject in the light of the Bacchanalian, B-A-C-C-H-A-N-A-L-I-N, the Bacchanalian, orgies, which, as the reader has seen, commemorate the history of Nimrod, it is evident that he led mankind to seek their chief good and the sensual enjoyment, and showed them how they might enjoy the pleasures of sin without any fear of the wrath of a holy Yahweh. In his various expeditions, he was always accompanied by troops of women, and by music and song, and games and revelries, and everything that could please the natural heart. He commended himself to the good graces of the mankind. Okay, it says, subsection 4, the death of the child. How Nimrod died, scripture is entirely silent. There was an ancient tradition that he came to a violent end. For the circumstances of that end, however, as antiquity represents them, are clouded with fable. It is said that tempest of the wind sent by Yahweh against the Tower of Babel overthrew it, that Nimrod perished in his ruins. This could not be true, for we have sufficient evidence that the Tower of Babel stood long after Nimrod's day. Then in regard unto the death of the Ninus, as the profane history speaks darkly and mysteriously, although one account tells of his having met with a violent death, similar to that of Pentheus, Lycurgus, and Orpheus, who were said to have been torn in pieces. The identity of Nimrod, however, and the Egyptian Osiris having been established, we have thereby lied as to Nimrod's death. Osiris met with a violent death. And that violent death for Osiris was the central theme of the whole idolatry of Egypt. If Osiris was Nimrod, as we have seen, that violent death which the Egyptians so pathetically deplored in their annual festival was just the death of Nimrod. The accounts in regard to the death of the god worshipped in the several mysteries of the different countries are also to the same effect. A statement of Plato seems to show that in his day the Egyptian Osiris was regarded as identical with Tammuz, and Tammuz as well known to have been the same as Adonis, the famous huntsman for whose death Venus is fabled to have made such bitter lamentation, as the women of Egypt wept for Osiris. As the Phoenician and Assyrian women wept for Tammuz, so in Greece and Rome the women wept for Bacchus, whose name, as we have seen, means the bewailed. or limited one. And now in connection with the Bacchanal, the Lamentations, the importance of the relation established between Nebros, the spotted fawn, and Nebrod, the mighty hunter, will appear. The Nebros, or spotted fawn, was the symbols of Bacchus as representing Nebrod, or Nebrod himself. Now, on certain occasions in the mythical celebration of the Nebros, our spotted fawn was torn in pieces, especially as we learn from Potus, as a commemoration of what happened to Bacchus, whom that fawn represented. The tearing in pieces of Nebros, the spotted one, goes to confirm the conclusion that the death of Bacchus, even as the death of Osiris, represented the death of Nimrod, whom under the very name of the spotted one the Babylonians worshipped. Though we do not find any account of the mysteries observed in Greece, in memory of the Orion, the giant and mighty hunter, celebrated by Homer under that name, yet he was represented symbolically as having died in a similar way to that in which Osiris died, and as having then been translated to heaven from the Persian records, as we are expressly assured that it was Nimrod who was deified after his death by the name of Orion and placed among the stars. Here then, we have large and concerning evidence, all leading to one conclusion, that the death of Nimrod, the child worshipped in the arms of the goddess mother of Babylon, was a death of violence. Now, when this mighty hero, in the midst of his career of glory, was suddenly cut off by a violent death, great seems to have been the shock that the catastrophe occasioned. When the news spread abroad, the devotees of pleasure felt as if the best benefactor of the mankind was gone, and the gaiety of the nations eclipsed. Loud was the wail that everywhere ascended to heaven among the apostates from the primeval faith for so dire a catastrophe. Then began those weeping for Tammuz and the guilt of which the daughters of Israel allowed themselves to be implicated, and the existence of which can be traced not merely in the annals of the classical antiquity, but in the literature of the world from Altima, Thule, to Japan. Of the prevalence of such weepings in China, thus speaks the Reverend W. Gillespie. The Dragon Boat Festival happens in midsummer and in a season of great excitement. About 2,000 years ago, there lived a young Chinese mandarin, Wat Yun, highly respected and beloved by the people. To the grief of all, he was suddenly drowned in the river. Many boats immediately rushed out in search of him, but his body was never found. Ever since that time, on the same day of the month, the dragon boats go out in search of him. It is something, adds the author, like the bewailing of Adonis or the weeping for Tammuz mentioned in the scripture. As the great god Buddha is generally represented in China as a Negro, that may serve to identify the beloved mandarin whose loss is thus annually bewailed. The religious system of Japan largely coincides with that of the China. In Iceland and throughout Scandinavia, there were similar lamentations for the loss of the god Balder, B-A-L-D-E-R. Balder, through the treachery of the god Loki, the spirit of evil, according as had been written in the Book of the Destiny, was slain, although the empire of the heaven depended on his life. His father Odin had learned the terrible secret from the Book of the Destiny, having conjured one of the Volar from her infernal abode. All the gods trembled at the knowledge of this event. Then Frigga, the wife of Odin, called on every object, animate and inanimate, to take an oath not to destroy or furnish arms against Balder. Fire, water, rocks, and vegetables were bound by this solemn obligation. One plant only, the mistletoe, was overlooked. Loki discovered the omission and made that contemptible shrub the fatal weapon among the warlike pastimes of the Valhalla, the assembly of the gods. One was to throw darts at the invulnerable deity, who felt a pleasure in presenting his charmed breast unto their weapons. At a tournament of this kind, the evil genius, putting a sprig of the mistletoe into the hands of the blind Hodir and directing his aim, the dreaded prediction was accomplished by an unintentional fratricide. For the spectators were struck with the speechless wonder, and their misfortune was the greater that no one, out of respect to the sacredness of the place, dared to avenge it. With the tears of lamentation, they carried the lifeless body to the shore and laid it upon a ship as a funeral pile. With that of Nanna, his lovely bride, who had died of a broken heart, his horse and arms were burnt at the same time. As was customary at the of Sikis, of the ancient heroes of the north, and Frigga, his mother, was overwhelmed with distress. Inconsolable for the loss of her beautiful son, says Dr. Crichton, she dispatched Hermod the swift to the abode of Hela, the goddess of hell or the infernal region, to offer a ransom for his release. The gloomy goddess promised that he should be restored, provided everything on earth were found to weep for him. Then were messengers sent over the whole world to see that the order was obeyed, and the effect of the general sorrow was as when there is a universal thaw. There are considerable variations from the original story and these two legends, but at the bottom, the essence of the stories is the same, indicating that they must have flowed from the one fountain. Subsection 5, the deification of the child. If there was one who was more deeply concerned in the tragic death of Nimrod than another, it was his wife Semiramis, who from an originally humble position had been raised to share with him the throne of Babylon. But in this emergency, shall she do? Shall she quietly forego the pomp and pride to which she had been raised? And no. Let's see. Though the death of her husband has given a rude shock to her power, yet her resolution and unbounded ambition were in no wise checked. On the contrary, her ambition took a still higher flight. In life, her husband had been honored as a hero, and thus she will have him worshipped as a god, yea, as a woman's promise. See, Zoroaster, who was destined to bruise the serpent's head, and who in doing so was to have his own heel bruised, the patriarchs in the ancient world in general were perfectly acquainted with the grand primeval promise of Eden, and they knew right well that the bruising of the heel of the promised seed implied his death and that the curse could be removed from the world only by the death of the Grand Deliverer. And the promise about the bruising of the serpent's head is recorded in the Genesis. As made to our first parents, was actually made. And if all mankind were descended from them, then it might be expected that some trace of this promise would be found in all the nations. And such is the fact. There is hardly a people or kindred on earth in whose mythology it is not shadowed forth. For the Greeks represented their great god Apollo as slaying the serpent Pytho, and Hercules as strangling serpents while yet in his cradle. In Egypt, in India, in Scandinavia, in Mexico, we find clear allusion to the same great truth. The evil genius, says Wilkerson, of the adversaries of the Egyptian god Horus, is frequently figured under the form of a snake, whose head he is seen piercing with a spear. For the same fable occurs in the religion of India, where the malignant serpent Chalaya is slain by Vishnu in his avatar of Krishna, and the Scandinavian deity Thor was said to have bruised the head of the great serpent with his mace. The origin of this, he adds, may be readily traced to the Bible. In reference to a similar belief among the Mexicans, we find Humboldt saying that the serpent crushed by the great spirit Chito, when he takes the form of one of the subaltern deities, and is a genius of evil. Ariel K. Co-Dam Damion. Now, in almost all cases, when the subject is examined to the bottom, it turns out that the serpent destroying Yahweh is represented as enduring hardships and sufferings that end in his death. Thus, the god Thor, while succeeding at last in destroying the great serpent, is represented as, in the very moment of victory, perishing from the venomous effluvia of his breath. The same would seem to be the way in which the Babylonians represented their great serpent destroyer among the figures of their ancient spheres. His mysterious sufferings is thus described by the Greek poet Erastus, whose language showed that when he wrote, the meaning of the representation had been generally lost, although when viewed in the light of the scriptures, it is surely deeply significant. A human figure, whelmed with Thor, appears, yet still with the name uncertain, he remains. Nor known of the labor that he thus sustains, but since upon his knees he seems to fall, him ignorant mortals Egonasis call. And while sublime his awful hands are spread, beneath him rose the dragon's horrid head, and his right foot unmoved appears to rest, fixed on the writhing monster's burnished crest. For the constellation thus represented is commonly known by the name of Aquila, and it's a fair description of the Greek poet, but it is plain that as Eugoneus came from the Babylonians, it must be interpreted, not in a Greek but in a Chaldean sense, and so interpreted as the action of the figure itself implies. The title of the mysterious sufferer is just the serpent crusher. Sometimes, however, the actual crushing of the serpent was represented as a much more easy process. Yet even then, death was the ultimate result. That the death of the serpent destroyer is so described as to leave no doubt whence the fable was borrowed. This is particularly the case with the Indian god Krishna, unto whom Wilkerson alludes in the extract already given. In the legend that concerns him, the whole of the primeval promise in Eden is very strikingly embodied. First, he is represented in pictures and images, with his foot on the great serpent's head. And then after destroying it, he is fabled to have died in consequence of being shot by an arrow in the foot. And as in the case of Tammuz, the great lamentations are annually made for his death, even in Greece. Also, in the classic story of Paris and Archilus, we have a very plain allusion to that part of the primeval promise which referred to the bruising of the conqueror's heel. Archilus, the only son of a goddess, was invulnerable in all points except the heel, but there a wound was deadly. At that, his adversaries took aim, and death was the result. Now, if there be such evidence still, that even pagans knew that it was by dying that the promised Messiah was to destroy death, and him that has the power of the death, that is the devil, how much more vivid must have been the impression of the mankind in general to regard to this vital truth in the early days of Semiramis, when they were so much nearer the fountainhead of all divine tradition, when therefore the name Zoroastus, the seated woman, was given unto him who had perished in the midst of a prosperous career of the false worship and apostasy, there can be no doubt of the meaning which that name intended to convey, and the fact of the violent death of the hero who, in the esteem of his partisans, had done so much to bless mankind, to make a life happy, and to deliver them from the fear of the wrath to come, instead of being fatal to the bestowal of such a title upon them. Favored rather than otherwise the daring design, all that was needed to countenance the scheme on the part of those who wished an excuse for the continued apostasy from the true Elohim was just to give out that though the great patron of the apostasy had fallen a prey to the malice of men, he had freely offered himself for the good of mankind. Now this is what was actually done. For the Chaldees version of the story of the great Zoroaster, is that he prayed to the Supreme God of Heaven to take away his life, that his prayer was heard, and that he expired assuring his followers that if they cherished due regard for his memory, the empire would never depart from the Babylonians. But Berosus, the Babylonian historian, says that the cutting off of the head of the great god Belus is plainly to the same effect. Belus, says Berosus, commanded one of the gods to cut off his head, that from the blood thus shed by his own command and with his own consent, when mingled with the earth, new creatures might be formed. The first creation being represented as a sort of a failure, thus the death of Belus, who was Nimrod, like that attributed unto Zoroaster, was represented as entirely voluntary and has submitted to for the benefit of the world. This brings the end of our study this hour. Contact us at the 11th hour call, and that's number 11. Click on the audio archive. We're going to close now with a song. Let the heavenly light shine through. Well, you had never known about a wonderful Yah if he had created you. And you had never known about his vast creation and all he can do. it to pray, let the heavenly light shine. And you are in His mercy when He comes again, oh, the heavenly home for you. Let the heavenly light shine through, let the heavenly light shine through. And you are in mercy when He comes again, oh, the heavenly home for you. There would not have been a creation of earth if God had not come down. He spoke the word and creation heard, and the world started spinning around. He spoke the word and the light appeared, He divided it from the night. And y'all saw that word was created by His mind. Let the heavenly light shine through, let the heavenly light shine through. And y'all in His mercy when He comes again, I'll have the heavenly home for you. Well, you climb up on a mountain and you look around, there's a green valley below. There's a moon up above that you're shining with love, there's a peaceful river that flows. There's the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees and all the heaven tents there. And I think that this is just a glimpse of what's a great and open day. Let the heavenly light shine through, let the heavenly light shine through. And God in His mercy when He comes again, we'll have a heavenly home for you. And God in His mercy when He comes again, we'll have a heavenly home for you.